BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is Wednesday, April 4th, 2012. My name is Ben Stone, and this is podcast number 128. We're rapidly approaching the one-year anniversary of our podcast. I think I've mentioned this a couple times. I'm going to try to encourage Kai to come back on with me and do a one-year anniversary podcast for that one-year anniversary podcast. And in addition to that, well, we'll just do a little Bad Quaker news update. Things that are going on at the old Bad Quaker compound here. So we are hoping to send Kai and two other of our staff to Porkfest this year. That's P-O-R-C-F-E-S-T, as in Porcupine Festival in New Hampshire. We are still attempting to, or planning to do that, to send them. Of course, I like to never speak in absolutes, so if anything comes up, then someone can't hold me to it later on. Oh, what else do we have going on? We are still taking feedback on the future funding for BadQuaker.com, if we should continue with sponsors attempting to sell airtime and ad time, or if we should just go strictly with voluntary donations. Any feedback you have on that, just go to badquaker.com and click on any of the spots there where you can add your comments and let us know. You can pretty much click on anywhere there where there's a comment section, and it'll get back through the ranks of the admins, and everybody will, all of us here will get to see it eventually. The other way you can give us feedback is either emailing badquaker@badquaker.com, that goes to the entire staff, or you can email Ben, that's me, ben@badquaker.com, ben@badquaker.com. And be sure to spell it Bad Quaker. There's been some confusion at times spelling Quaker, Q-U-A-C-K-E-R, like quacker. But Quaker is actually Q-U-A-K-E-R, no C at all in the word. So ben@badquaker.com. Also, just as a consideration, to try to offset the cost of ascending people to Porkfest, we were considering a couple different things as to how the people could sort of, pay their own way. Because, as libertarians, we believe, as they say over there at the quasi-libertarian website, Cato.com, that there is no free lunch. And I'm sure that's taken from some other libertarian at some point in time. I'm not sure the original source of that, but I know it is a very old saying. But one of the things we're considering for the folks going to Porkfest, we have an abundance of, within our group, we have an abundance of turquoise, jewelry quality turquoise. And so some of them were considering, well, we could always make and sell turquoise jewelry, perhaps hemp turquoise jewelry or something like that. And the suggestion was also brought forth of t-shirts, possibly even, it was kind of kicked around as a joke, but Quaker hats. The problem with a Quaker hat is that you can't really put a logo on a Quaker hat. It's kind of kind of self-contradictory. It's like, bacon on a bagel. You just kind of feel odd about it when you do that. But we were considering stuff like that, maybe some Bad Quaker t-shirts or Bad Quaker stickers or something along that lines. But if you have any feedback on that, be sure and let us know. Whatever, good or bad, positive, negative, whatever you think. Now, I did create some confusion in two podcasts in a row where in one podcast, I compared the state to a colony of ants, And then in another podcast, I redid that and compared libertarian utopia to A Colony of Ants. And I can see why it's kind of confusing, because I talked in a giant circle. But essentially, if you go back and listen to the first one, which was, I don't know, they're all confusing in my mind. Whichever podcast that was where I was talking about what is the state, I think it's titled something like Understanding What the State Really Is or something like that. And I think I rambled on for about 40 minutes before I actually took on the topic, if I recall. But that's unusual, huh? Anyway, to get to my topic. So in one podcast, in the first of the two podcasts, I said that, you know, I was comparing things that the state is similar to. And I said, in ways, the state is similar to an ant colony. And then I went through some of the comparisons of how the state is like an ant colony. And to give you an idea, and I don't think I mentioned this, but just to make it even more confusing, I'll throw it out now. In an ant colony, you have each little worker ant is doing his own thing, and he doesn't really have any ambition to do anything else. It's not like the nursery ant worker wants to someday grow up and go out into the big world and collect seeds, or the seed ant worker doesn't have ambitions of someday becoming a soldier ant worker. They all pretty much fit within their duties. They know what they're supposed to do by nature. They do what they do, and they don't think about it any beyond that. Now, this is, in a sense, this is a very close description of what Marx describes in his socialist utopia, in his New Socialist Man, that where the garbage man is happy to be the garbage man and has no ambition whatsoever to move up or to take on greater responsibility or to do a lighter job or a different job. He realizes how important his job is, and he's happy to be the one contributing as the garbage man. And of course, the problem with that, even that Marx understood, was that man would have to change his nature dramatically in order to become that new socialist man. And of course, Marx provided no mechanism of how that would take place, other than, you know, if you think about it logically, then there is the one method of killing everybody who has any inclination of their own liberty, and leaving nothing but the useless sheep behind, who can imagine nothing but serving the state by repetitiously doing their work over and over. So that brought on the progressive movement in the early 1900s, and they very often believed in eugenics, which was pretty much what I just described. The killing off of the undesirables in society, leaving only those that will develop into this perfect socialist man. So yes, in a sense, the ant colony is very much like a socialist utopia, if you could get human beings to behave in Marx's perfect socialist man type of behavior. Of course, they won't, because it's against human nature to do that. The other difference, and I pointed this out in the first first time that I talked about this, the other difference between the ant colony and the state is that the state is and socialism require central planning. Now, the state itself, the myth of the state, I talk a lot about the distinction between government and state. So the state itself, the myth of the state, actually doesn't require central planning. But the state can't exist without a government, without a host government. And all governments are based on central planning. Therefore, all governments are socialist-based. Now, some people either don't want to think about that, or they'll try to reject it outright. But even if they reject it outright, it's because they've chosen not to think about it. Government, we're talking about coercive government, government that's based on the model of the state, where certain people are designated as having more rights than others or more authority than others, and therefore they can behave in a way that others can't behave. This is the model of the state, and this is how virtually every government that exists today exists under this model of the state. So under the myth of the state, every government is a tiny little socialist model of central planning, of the monopoly of violence, and an attempt to have a monopoly on the means of production. Every government eventually seeks to control things like wages, seeks to control the money supply, seeks to control immigration, seeks to control all these things in order to give it a central planning of all things within first the economy and then individual lives. This is what governments do. And it's the myth of the state that feeds that and gives that government the supposed authority to behave like that. Well, the anthill actually does not use central planning. It does not use a coercive government of any kind. Every individual contributing in the ant colony does so because it's within their nature to do so. So in that sense, it's not like the government. The ant colony is not like the state because the ant colony exists without central planning, and all governments based on the state require central planning. So the difference between the ant colony and the perfect socialist utopia is that the ants do that by nature, but that's not the nature of mankind. Now, to compare and the thing that got confusing was then the second podcast that I did, where I went back and retouched the same topic, I actually used the ant colony as an example of anarchy as to why anarchy can work, because here you have an example in nature of an entire society of voluntary, ants, doing all of their stuff voluntarily. So in that sense, it's an example of how the hand of anarchy, that invisible hand that Smith wrote about, it does those things on its own without there actually being anyone in control. Now, just to make it more confusing, of course, going back to the socialist version of the socialist utopia, and comparing that to an ant colony, keeping in mind that in the socialist utopia, where Marx dreamed of, where everybody just does exactly what they're supposed to do and they don't question authority and all these other things, the state itself, I would argue, unlike the ant colony, the state itself is an actual entity that has a self-conscious, it's conscious of itself, it learns, it adapts, it makes mistakes. It has certain desires, and it has a certain driving will. And that will is to take over everywhere as much as possible, to fill every part of the world with the dominance of the state. And an ant colony really doesn't have whatever it is that drives the ant colony, whatever it is within that community of ant colony, they don't necessarily have the desire to seek out other ants for the purpose of extinguishing them. They don't have the desire to, build up a false enemy in some other ant colony so that they can go and invade it and rob it and kill all of its inhabitants and bring them into subservience. And yet, in a governmental setting, the state very much encourages that type of behavior with governments. So there are similarities and there are these differences. And I said before that in attempting to prove that the state itself is an actual entity, that as all these collective people all around the world believe in the state actually takes on a personality and takes on a consciousness and an entity, and it plans and it thinks and it's self-aware and it learns and it adapts. Now, that's a pretty bold statement right there, and like I said, I'll have to do a whole article just supporting that one thought. I kind of covered that to a certain extent in an article that I did called Wake Up Morbius, or was that an article, or was that just a free-flowing podcast I did? No, I think I wrote that down. I think that was an article. Anyway, where I talked about the id in that old sci-fi classic Forbidden Planet, where the id monster that came from Morbius's mind haunted the surface of the planet and killed people and did destruction and all these horrible things. So I kind of touched on it there. Of course, that was just another metaphor. That wasn't necessarily an actual evidence-based article, but something else to think about. And if you haven't seen, or actually heard, not seen, but if you haven't heard that podcast about Wake Up Morbius, you can just do a search on the badquaker.com website for the word Morbius, and I'm sure it'll take you to one of the articles that I've done on that or one of the podcasts. Okay, now, so that was like 15 minutes of rambling, and I'm not really sure if I covered the point or not. That's the problem of not having a co-host here, of not having Kai with me, because Kai has a tendency to center my ramblings and keep me on target, and she will return me back to my points if I don't finish them. So that's the real disadvantage to just having me in front of a mic rambling away like that. But hopefully I've straightened that out a little bit, the confusion that I developed with using the ant colony as both an example of socialism and the state, and using it also as an example of how anarchy can work. And of course, what it really boils down to is the nature of each individual animal, because it's well within the nature of those ants to behave that way, but it's not at all within the nature of a human being to behave that way. So if a human being or any other animal acts outside of the realm of its natural laws that govern it as a species, then it's almost guaranteed that it will doom itself to, if not death, at least a less productive life than it would have had it obeyed the natural laws of its species. And that's where, and I tried to make this point in both those podcasts, that's where we are as humans. We have, by accepting the myth of the state and therefore coercive government that is the natural result of that myth, by accepting the myth of the state, we have adopted unnatural laws that are strange to our species. And in doing so, we have, on a mass scale, especially in the last 200 years, as the state has really grown out of proportion, as this has taken place, we have, rather than experiencing the full blessing of the abundance of the technology that has developed and the economic boom that's taken place in the last couple hundred years, instead we've tasted a bit of the boom, but nothing like we could have had the state not been there fouling up the whole process with its unnatural laws. So that's what I was talking about, that any other animal that's violating its natural laws, even if it doesn't die right away, it's not living to the level of prosperity that it would if it were following natural laws. That being the case with humans in the last couple hundred years, by not following natural laws, whatever prosperity that we've seen in the last couple hundred years pales to what we could have seen had we been following natural law. An example of that I can just toss out. Now, I'm not going to quote Murray Rothbard precisely, because I try to avoid using such language, but there was a moment where Murray Rothbard had decided to research the almost universally accepted lie that's sold to us. You can find this lie. Just go to Google and put in the words Eli Whitney, or even just Whitney and cotton gin, or just maybe even just the word cotton gin, and look up the story of Eli Whitney. And here's basically what you're going to find. And you'll find a variation of it, a slight variation, but I'll tell you basically what you're going to find. Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin. Prior to Eli Whitney, there may have been a few attempts at a cotton gin, but they were unsuccessful. But when Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin, he was able to replace the labor of, and now we make up some figures, but it's something like 20 men or 200 men or something like that, with just one person cranking a handle. Whatever it was, it's not important enough for me to even look up, because it's all lies anyway. So he could replace the labor of all these men with this one special box and one man cranking a handle to separate the seeds from the cotton. Now, some references to this story will tell you that the real problem is that there had been cotton gins for thousands of years, which there had. There were cotton gins going back to ancient China, ancient India, and ancient Egypt. But what some sources will tell you is that the particular breed of wild cotton that grew in the American Southeast was a short strand cotton, as opposed to the long strand cotton that was of Asian origin. So the cotton gins that were developed in Asia specifically didn't work on the cotton from the American Southeast. And there's a certain amount of truth to that. But then the myth goes on and they say, okay, so Eli Whitney invented this cotton gin, but the problem was that he wanted to charge such outrageous fees to use his cotton gin that it outraged the farmers. They considered it a tax. And so they didn't want to pay this, so they ended up pirating his box. And he ended up spending a fortune trying to pursue his patent rights. And eventually, cotton gins became so common throughout the South that he couldn't stop them, and he went on and did other things to make his fortune. Well, that's kind of true and kind of not true. And going back to Murray Rothbard, when Murray finally studied and dug through writings and got away from the official state story and away from the official fifth grade government school story that sold to the entire public, and when the entire public just believes it with wide open eyes, when Murray was able to push past all that nonsense and find out the truth, this is essentially the story that he found. There were functioning cotton gins throughout the South. However, because of the low cost proportionately of slave labor, there was very little incentive to there was more than one thing. The inexpensiveness of slave labor was one issue as to why, you know, if you had your choice of putting four or five very inexpensive slaves onto a job or spending a lot of money on a box that would do the job for you. And there's a lot of other factors involved as well. But if you were a farmer in the American Southeast, you'd have to weigh that that in a balance. Now, we're talking pre-Eli Whitney invention days, because keep in mind, the idea that Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin, that part's just a flat lie. So prior to his so-called invention, there were, in the Southeast, functional cotton gins. Now, the problem with the cotton gins that were common, and there were a variety of designs, but the problem with them was that they would plug up pretty regularly. So now here's the real part of the story that involves Eli Whitney. Eli Whitney came from a very comfortable family, and he had a comfortable education. And when he got out of his comfortable education at Yale, he decided to hobnob with some of the the upper crust in society. So he was attending a party. This is one of these debutante type balls that they used to have among the rich in those days. And so he's attending this party, and there were some planters there, some cotton growers. And they were discussing among themselves the shortcomings of the different cotton gins that were available to them in those days, and how oftentimes it was just easier to assign some slaves to the job and let them clean the cotton. And one of the women present at the party, knowing how other machinery worked, like spinning wheels and that type of machinery, she said, "Well, why doesn't somebody just make a machine with a spinning part that does this and another thing that does that, and that way it would clean that part that plugs, and you wouldn't have that." And generally, you know, you can imagine, we're talking late 1700s, and there are men speaking, and some lady has an opinion. I mean, who would listen to that? Well, Eli Whitney did. Eli Whitney, fresh out of college, fresh out of Yale, being the dandy that he was and listening to all the ladies talk and trying his best to, you know, to fit into the upper society and everything, heard that and he went, that might work. And so what did he do? Did he run out and make this invention and improve on it? And then, no, what he did was he ran immediately to the patent office and tried to lock up the patent on the entire process of on all cotton gins. His attempt was to get a monopoly control of the market based on the violence of government. Now think this through for a minute. This is not a good person. This is not a noble venture. And he didn't invent squat. He heard somebody else come up with an idea. He stole the idea. Then he tries to use the force of government to inflict upon everybody else his monopoly so that he can solely make money off of it. Yes, he did improve the existing design of functional cotton gins. However, in his quest to control the monopoly on the cotton gin market, he spent more money in that process than he was able to earn. And he actually retarded the business, held back innovation in the business that may have cost 20 or 30 years of product development, maybe 20 or 30 years of economic development among different people. In addition to that, now some people will say that, well, this made slavery more profitable. That no, there's a lot of different factors involved. For instance, within the same time frame, the slave trade itself changed dramatically. The so-called triangle trade, which was, if I recall, it was rum. It was slaves for rum, for sorghum, or something like that. I can't remember exactly. Tobacco, slaves, tobacco, and rum. Anyway, whatever the triangle trade was, I can't remember now. I'd have to look it back up. I haven't thought about those things in years. But the triangle trade that actually brought slaves out of Africa into the U.S., right in that time frame, that got cut off as well. And laws were changed, and there was restrictions involved in bringing in new slaves. So the cost of slaves changed. There was a whole series of things that took place. The amount of land and the way land was being distributed in the Southeast changed. There was an uprooting of the native Indians, American Indians, that had peaceably been settled throughout the South, and they were uprooted, and their land was just arbitrarily given to upper-class Southern rich families. And those Indians that had been on that land peaceably and had been promised that they'd be able to keep their land, we're not talking about people on a reservation here. We're talking about guys, a family who lived on the next farm next to yours, and they happen to be Cherokee, and so the government just says, hey, guess what? You have to move to Oklahoma, and your farm now belongs to somebody else. And it was just that cut and dry. So all these factors were involved in bringing about the antebellum South that existed where cotton was king. Eli Whitney and his supposed invention were one small aspect of that. But it was just one small aspect. And the fact that he didn't actually invent anything, that all he did was patent something and then attempt to hold a monopoly on it for a number of years, it twists the whole story. We're about close enough in time frame to do our commercial break, so I'm going to cut off there. We'll do the commercial break, and I'll try to make this sound a little bit more sane when I come back. Thanks a lot, folks. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from badquaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to badquaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at survival gear bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help badquaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support badquaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do? Well, you go to badquaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from badquaker.com. Thanks, folks. Thanks for sticking with me through the commercials, folks. And so be sure and get over there to badquaker.com and click those links and let the fine folks at Survival Gear Bags and over at Shire Silver know that where you came from, where how you got to their website. And I should mention that I'm glad to hear that Kelly at Survival Gear Bags has now been picked up by the Freedom Fiends as one of their sponsors as well. So congratulations to Kelly on that. And Kelly, I hope your business really takes off and I hope it does really well. No matter what we decide to do over here at Bad Quaker with advertising, I really hope you I wish for you the best in your in Survival Gear Bags. And you know I'm hoping for you there, buddy. Okay, now I was talking about Eli Whitney, but I wanted to give one other example from the same time frame to give you an idea of something that was going on around the same time. There was a guy named Watt in England that is generally credited with inventing the steam engine. Well, of course, that's a myth. The steam engine, in one form or another, has gone all the way back into like ancient Egypt and so forth. It's a very old device. And actually, Watt was sort of a engineer or mechanic working on a functional steam engine when he got the idea of a particular type of a valve. And his idea about this valve was a pretty good idea. Unlike Eli Whitney, he didn't steal his idea. He actually thought of it himself, and he was an actual engineer. And so he had this idea about this valve that could make the steam engine dramatically more efficient. At that time, steam engines were, there was two things. First off, they weren't very efficient, and second off, they were extremely dangerous. And the reason they were extremely dangerous is because if you consider what metallurgy was like in the mid-1700s and what technology was like in the mid-1700s, metallurgy and technology specifically in the realm of machine shops changed dramatically from 1750 to about 1810 in that range. Things like standardized screw depth and things like standardized direction for nuts and bolts to turn, stuff like this was just starting to come into the mechanical realm. So when Watt was working on a steam engine, the steam engine that existed already, it was extremely dangerous, extremely unstable, and it wasn't very efficient. So Watt's idea was a dramatic improvement on the efficiency. And so what did Watt do? Well, he immediately attempted to sew up the patent rights on all steam engines. The problem was, and the government backed him up on his aggressive violence on this. And so he kept trying to prevent anyone else from either making a steam engine or even improving on his ideas. He held back technology for years as he spent a fortune pursuing his patent rights, so-called patent rights, on the steam engine. And the tricky part is he couldn't even build the steam engine himself because the flywheel technology and some of the other aspects of the steam engines that had already existed before he invented his valve, those had patents on them that belonged to other people that wouldn't work with him. So not only did he not allow anybody else to build a steam engine, not only did he not allow anyone else to innovate the steam engine, he couldn't build steam engines himself because the patents were sewn up by other people who wouldn't give him the patent rights to develop his steam engine. So for that reason, about 50 years went by, and there were no developments in the steam engine because he personally, Watt, held them down and kept innovation from taking place. And in addition to that, as I was saying a moment ago, there were new technologies coming on board, standardization in things like thread depth and thread width and thread pitch and thread direction. And all these things were critical to machine shops developing out of the cobbler level of technology and into a true into a true machine shop. So it's not one thing. It's not, you know, oh, Watt invented the steam engine and then the technological revolution took place and we had all of the manufacturing in the 1800s. No, that's a myth. That's a lie of the state. The same with the lies of the state when in regards to Eli Whitney. Oh, everything was held down. Nobody knew how to clean cotton. And then all of a sudden Eli Whitney invents this machine and everybody's happy. And we got slaves working like crazy, whipping out the cotton. And this created the boom in the South and no, lies, all lies. There were a whole variety of technologies. Everything had to fall in place for these things to happen. To take this simplistic view of the late 1700s of where just an invention by Eli Whitney and an invention by Watt, and Fuller is thrown in there as well with his steam-powered boat. But typically, the way the storyline is read, these individual superheroes invented these couple things, and the next thing you know, technology took off. And it's all because they were able to patent their... No, all that is a lie. All that is lies of the state. I mentioned Murray Rothbard earlier. When Murray, the moment... his wife actually recounted this in her speaking about Murray. But when he finally found the evidence that Eli Whitney was a fake, he was so excited and just bubbled over about it, and he couldn't express his joy enough that he had found out that Eli Whitney was a fake. And again, I won't repeat the vulgarities that Murray expressed within his joyous discovery that, in fact, Eli Whitney was a fake. But if you recall, if you've listened to the podcast here long enough, then you'll recall that I talked about this with the Wright brothers. The same myth exists with the Wright brothers. I'm located here in Western Ohio, near Dayton, Ohio, and it's hard to swing a cat by the tail without hitting somebody who's worshiping the Wright brothers in one form or another. And I don't actually support the swinging of cats by the tail. That's an old word, old phrase, but you get my point either way. Here in the Dayton, Ohio area, the worship of the Wright brothers is just rampant. And yet the Wright brothers did more within the few years that the government allowed them their monopoly on in their industry, in their chosen industry. The Wright brothers did more to hold back the development of airplanes in North America than any single individuals. Their arguments with Curtis whether or not he could utilize his experiments and try to improve on designs, they basically made it was their pursuing of their patents that caused the deaths of other people, all the way to the point of where, even though their patents were enforced by the aggression of the government itself condemned the Wright brothers' planes as being too dangerous to fly because so many people were getting killed with them just trying to get them off the ground. And the Wright brothers knew this. They knew their planes were a fake. They knew their planes were unstable and were not airworthy. And so when they attempted to sell them, first to the United States government, and then later to the French government, and the German government, and the Italian government, when the Wright brothers attempted to sell their planes, they wanted to sell them sight unseen and without a demonstration. And the reason that they wanted to do that, it was because they knew they were frauds. And yet, if you listen to the storyline that's sold to us by the government, you would think that the Wright brothers actually invented flight. No, they did not. They hindered, they got a patent, and then they hindered flight for many years. And I did a whole podcast on that, so there's not really a big need to go over and over and over in it. So what would we do without the government? Well, we wouldn't have these restrictions on innovation, and we wouldn't and people would innovate. Think about the eruption of the internet and all the computer technology that took place from the 1930s when tube type computers began to be developed. The U.S. government and the English government as well, because similar things were happening in the U.K., the governments clamped down on the development of these computers, these tube-based computers. The government only saw a couple uses for them, and that was to control naval fire and as sighting devices for aircraft bombing. That's the only thing that the government could really see as a useful thing for these new computers that were being invented. So the government locked down production, locked down innovation, wouldn't let private companies have the technology or use the technology, wouldn't allow innovation to take place. As time developed in the post-World War II era, the certain companies literally begged the governments to open up the computer world into business, at least to some extent, so that they could sell some of their products to business rather than only supplying to government. So as they did this, and keeping in mind that computers in one form or another have existed a very long time, but we're talking about the development of tube-based computers in the 1930s up into the 1950s when the governments eventually started to allow business to start to use these new computers. But still, it was very restricted, and this kept the computer prices very, very high. It kept innovation extremely limited, and the governments of the world still saw the only real use for computers was for things like, again, controlling the bombing of the release of bombs from aircraft, the control of naval fire, and the new technology of rocketry. They figured out that computers could be used to control rocketry, and therefore, you know, basically guided missiles, which is what the ICBMs were. Okay, so as more and more of this genie got out of the bottle during the 1960s, by the late 1960s, amateurs were starting to fiddle around and making their own little computers. And somehow this slipped past the government because they were making stuff that wasn't necessarily covered by the existing patents that had been tied up by the big companies like IBM and so forth. So by the early 70s, these innovators working literally in their mom's basement and in their mom's garage and places like that were able to break the quietly and secretly break the grasp of the government and bring computers out into the free, so to speak, the free world, the non-governmental world. And once the mid to late 70s got here and the innovators in the computer industry were beginning to get out of control, it spiraled away from the government's control so fast that the government couldn't do anything about it. Thus, the internet broke away from the government. Thus, personal computers got out of the government's hands, and we have the entire explosion of innovation that we've had since the 1970s in the area of computers. Now the government is starting to crack back down on this stuff again, and as fast as it can, it's trying to get control of this genie and cram it back in the bottle. But what would things be like if the government were not restricting the development of computers for all those years? What if instead of waiting until 1969, 1970, 1974 for these innovators in Silicon Valley in their mom's garage, what if instead of waiting until then for these guys to start developing this stuff, if the innovators would not have been held back by the government in the 1930s, what if we would have had personal computing by the mid-1940s? You say, oh, we couldn't because World War II. Well, guess what? That was a product of the state. That was not the product of private business. That was a product of the fascist marriage between giant corporations and evil governments. That's what produced World War II for us. Don't fool yourself. World War II, don't believe the government's lies. World War II was not just one little guy with a mustache trying to conquer the world. World War II was the result of World War I, and all of that was the result of this marriage of these giant mega corporations and these evil governments trying their best to manipulate things and gain as much power as possible. So without the government's interference in the 1930s, what if we would have had personal computers by the mid-1940s like we did by the mid-1970s? Where would things be today? Where would commerce be today? If people could suddenly start to handle their bookkeeping and handle their payroll in the far more efficient manner that we have now, if that would have taken place in the 1940s, where would we be at today? What wealth level would we be at now if all of that innovation had not been held down by the governments of the world? Where would we be? Okay, now I wanted to touch on one other thing, and it's not quite as pleasant. All this stuff is fun. This is like this is almost like the steampunk thing that Kai and I talked about a couple times, where you can just let your imagination go and think, where would things be without the government interference? Where would, you know, what would we have? Flying cars? Would we still need roads? Would, you know, all these things? The mind just roars and just goes crazy thinking about the wonders of what the market could have produced if it weren't for the state. But I need to break off of that and touch something a little less pleasant and a little less fun to play with in mind games like that. I saw a YouTube video that was just so sad. I don't really know how to start this out. The person who did the video, I think, has listened to a couple of these podcasts, but I don't think they've ever really listened regularly, and I don't think they paid attention when they did listen. And then, in addition to that, it appears, well, it's stated in the YouTube video, the person had listened to a Stefan Molyneux YouTube, and, like, half-listened, and made some assumptions, and therefore jumped to some conclusions. And then he made this video as an answer to Stefan Molyneux's video. Now, here's the problem with that. There's a old, and this will apply to geeks and old people. If you're a Saturday Night Live geek, you'll know what I'm talking about. Or if you're old, like me, you might have a tendency to know what I'm talking about. In the old Saturday Night Live days, we're talking mid-70s, there was a character that was played by, I can't remember her name. She was married to Gene Wilder until she died of cancer. I can't remember her name. She was one of the original Saturday Night Live crew, and she was wonderfully funny. I wish I would have made some notes for today. I would have put her name in the notes. Gilda Radner. There we go. Okay, I stalled long enough until I remembered it. So there was a Gilda Radner, a recurring Gilda Radner sketch that she would do. And I can't remember the name of the person, but it was during their news segment. And she would come out and she would, and then they would introduce her. And she would come out and say, what's all this talk about Saxon violins on TV? I like saxophones and I like violins. And she would just ramble on and on and on. And about halfway into it, they would say, it's sex and violence, not sax and violins. What? Oh, never mind. Now, if you know that skit, you'll know what I'm talking about. But hopefully I described it good enough that you get the gist of it, because it was always the same shtick. She would always ramble on and on about something, and then well into it, they would interrupt her and indicate that, you know what, you really have no clue what you're talking about. And then it would dawn on her, and then she would just say, never mind. So unfortunately, that's what happened in this YouTube video. Stefan Molyneux evidently had done a YouTube saying, you know, basically voting is not going to accomplish what you think it's going to accomplish. And he had done, Steph aimed the YouTube towards Ron Paul supporters, which he has done several YouTubes aimed at Ron Paul supporters. So I'm not really sure exactly which one that this person had heard, and I'm not really sure, but it doesn't matter, because I got a pretty good grasp of Stefan's policies and the things that he believes. And I don't, you know, there are, if Steph and I could sit down, and I'll use this opportunity again to point out that I've asked him on this podcast twice he's accepted, and then twice he didn't come on. So I'm thinking I might have to do like a Photoshop thing where I put a picture of me next to a picture of him and question, like, what's the matter, Stefan? How come you're afraid to come on Bad Quaker Podcast? Is this a follically dominance issue? I'm thinking of doing some mocking of Stefan like that in a good-natured way, because I like Stefan. I mean, you know, I started to say this a second ago. If Stefan and I could sit down and talk for an hour or two, there are some things that we see vividly different. The obvious is the atheism and theism aspect. But even if you set that aside, there are a variety of things that we see very different. I don't think Stefan really looks at the difference between state and government in the same way that I do. I don't think he sees the state as in the same way that I see the state. And there's some other aspects that Stefan and I would disagree on, specifically in regards to the functioning of family and self-protection as well. There's a few things that Stefan and I would disagree on. But we're talking about, you know, in the 100% realm of everything that he and I believe, we're talking 2 or 3% that we would disagree on, maybe 5% that we would disagree on. So I'm fairly confident that the YouTube that I'm talking about, that I'm not linking to, because I don't want to give the poor guy, I don't want to humiliate the poor guy, and I don't want to give him extra hits that he doesn't need either. But in his attempt to debunk Stefan's video, he really sounds a lot like that Saturday Night Live skit, because he basically has the understanding that Stefan's policy is that the way you deal with the voting issue is you give up. And Stefan, like the things that I have said, is not saying that we give up on politics. What Stefan is saying is that politics is not the answer. So it's like, let's say, what can I compare this to? Let's say you're digging a ditch. And you're going to dig this ditch. The ditch is going to be 200 yards long, it's going to be 3 feet deep, and it's going to be 3 feet wide. And you're the only one out there digging it, so it's going to take you some serious effort, and it's going to take you some serious time. And so you decide, okay, I'm going to go out and dig the ditch. Okay, so what am I going to dig the ditch with? Oh, I know, I'm going to dig the ditch with a banana. And so you're out there with your banana trying to dig the ditch. And Stefan comes up and says, buddy, what you're doing there is not doing what you think it's doing. And you're convinced, hey, I'm digging the ditch. I got to do something. I can't just give up. I got to dig this ditch. And Stefan basically is saying, A, you're not going to ever get the ditch dug with the banana. And B, you're not actually going to get the ditch dug ever. Because guess what? You're standing on the deck of an aircraft carrier. You can't dig through it. It's not what you think. There is no dirt here. You're imagining that there's a place to dig a ditch. There's not only can you not dig a ditch with that banana, You can't dig a ditch on the deck of this aircraft carrier, even if you had a shovel, because you can't dig through the deck of the aircraft carrier. Now, that's a weird comparison, but this is how ridiculous it is, thinking that you're going to organize and you're going to get some people together and you're all going to vote and you're going to change the government, and the government's going to somehow magically going to go back to following the Constitution that you so heavily worship. This is all going to be good. And this is what he says on the video. You just don't understand. We have this Constitution. All we have to do is get back to the Constitution. Dude, put the banana down. Look at your feet. You're not standing on dirt. There is no Constitution. The Constitution is fake. The Constitution has been fake since it was written. It has never done what it was sold to the people that it would do. There's never been a time when the Constitution, quote unquote, worked. It's fake. You've been sold a bill of goods. And as long as you insist upon believing and trusting your Constitution and your faith in government, you're never going to really realize that you're not standing where you think you're standing. And this is the real issue with people who think that somehow you can all organize and you can get the government to work right. And in the video, in the YouTube that I'm complaining about here, he goes on to say, oh, throughout the ages, this has happened over and over in history. Whenever a government was so bad, then the people just changed it. And what happened? Think about this for a minute. Let's step back, like I've talked about so many times, all the way back to Jericho, or any time since then. Jericho being the oldest known manifestation of the state that we have actual evidence for. At any point in time that you can just drop a needle on that point in time and say, okay, let's examine the state at this point, and you figure out what the state was doing and what it was like then. Since that time to now, the state has continually grown stronger, bigger, more powerful in every way, more intrusive into private life. The state has not shrunk. We do not have more liberty now than we've ever had before. We have the least amount of liberty that we have ever had in human history, ever, right now, because the state is bigger and stronger and more intrusive into our lives than it has ever been in history. And it will get worse. It will not get better. And the more you fiddle with it, the more powerful it becomes, because all you're doing is being a part of it and feeding it and making it work better and better. And this wild, crazy hope that if we could just get Ron Paul or whoever your magic candidate is to go in there and get things back to the Constitution, then what would he do? What would he really do? Would he just fix the finances of the monster that we're facing so that it can have a better credit rating and take out more loans that your children have to pay? When you think that you're going to put off the evils of government for 4 years or for 6 years or for 8 years or even for one generation, if you think you're going to get involved in government, use the power of government, improve government, all you're really doing is committing the ultimate act of selfishness onto your grandchildren. Because what you're doing to them is you're creating a more efficient government that will oppress them in ways that you can't imagine. So what do we do? Do we give up? What do we do? What do we do? What do we do? You stop smacking the banana into the deck of the aircraft carrier and realize there's no ditch. There's no ditch. The state is a myth. And as long as you believe that myth and trust in that myth, then you're going to seek government to fix your problems. But if you can get that myth purged, exercised from your mind, exercise that myth from your mind, free your head, and then you'll realize you don't have to dig a ditch. You don't have to try to convince government to fix itself and follow its own rules. The whole thing will disappear, and your great-grandchildren will thank you for it because they'll be free. Or you can perpetuate the myth and keep fiddling with government, and you'll just get stronger and stronger government. So what do you do? Do we do nothing? Do we do nothing? No. Learn about the myth. Once you understand it, teach others. That's something. Okay? continuing to play with the government is doing nothing. Voting is doing nothing. Folks, for more on liberty, zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much.